Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions and investments editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, despite the threat of Omicron, inflation proved the greater risk as the Bank of England finally raised interest rates. But was it the right move? Will it actually do anything to curb soaring inflation? And how will a rate rise impact your finances? Also today, the new state pension age. As we're told to work longer, when will you be able to retire? Meanwhile, Tanya has an update on the state pension delays. Could we finally see a crackdown on fraudulent ads and move over premium bonds? Christmas is going crypto. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, after much will they, won't they did. The Bank of England decided to raise rates this week from the record low of 0.1% to 0.25%, rather against expectations. It's all in response to inflation, which hit 5.1%. But will it actually do anything? And how will it hit us in the pocket? Tanya, welcome. Firstly, a bit of a surprise, this move?
Yes. In fact, I think when I was last on the podcast, I thought that they would wait to the new year. And with Omicron, I think a lot of people with the uncertainty in the economy right now would have understood if it had gone back. Reading the comments, though, from the people involved and Andrew Bailey talking about it, it seems like they considered Omicron really carefully and took it into account, but were weighing that directly against inflation. And the 5.1% inflation really seemed to put the wind up them. The IMF weighed in as well and warned about inaction bias, and that might have prodded them into it as well. But what Andrew Bailey was basically saying was that the Omicron crisis, although it might seem like the activity is being dampened, it might actually not have an effect on inflation. And in fact, it might even send the inflation rate even higher. And so therefore, I suppose they felt that they had to act.
Right. I mean, you could be forgiven for thinking when they decided not to do anything in November, Simon, that the situation was less precarious than we're in right now. But will it actually have any impact, this decision, on inflation?
Well, I think that the situation in November, to reflect on your first point, did look much better. We were in normality, well, of a type, but certainly a hell of a lot closer to normality than we are at the moment. Unfortunately, we've gone backwards at the moment with Omicron, but for all its infectiousness, we're in a very, very different place to the place that we were in a year ago. I was listening to Sir John Bell on the radio the other day, and he pointed out that the vaccination program last year, not the booster program, which he said is a nice thing to have and it's great, but the vaccination program last year, all those double jabbed people saw deaths and hospitalizations absolutely fall off a cliff. And we've had numerous COVID waves since, and we're having another one now. We've still got lots of vaccinated people. All of the numbers point to this not being the same problem that we had this time last year and the same problem that we had in the initial burst of coronavirus. So there's your glass half full bit. The glass half empty bit is that if you go out to the high streets, to the pubs, to the restaurants, to the places that were thriving 2 weeks ago, they are looking pretty empty right now. I cycled back from the office on Wednesday evening to St. Pancras, and it takes me through the back streets of Marylebone and places like that. And it was really sad to see all those restaurants, all those pubs, all those places that should be absolutely rammed at this time of year, taking in a load of money after a really, really tough year, half empty. Same is true of a lot of shopping streets and things like that. It's maybe not so bad once you get out of the city centres, but certainly the city centres are suffering. And that is going to have an economic impact. How big is that economic impact going to be, however? It's only one chunk of the economy. And actually, the retail sector, up until right now, has been doing quite well because people freaked out a bit about Christmas presents this year and decided that leaving it till the last minute might be a bad idea, seeing as at some points they walked into the supermarkets and there was hardly anything in there. And so maybe they should actually buy some Christmas presents in advance. So if you look to some of the big retailers, M&S, for example, they've actually been doing pretty well. So obviously hospitality is suffering. We've had talk of whether they're going to need help. I think the Bank of England is going, okay, this is a temporary setback. You don't just move upwards in a straight line. Sometimes you get a dip along the way. Inflation is a big problem. We have to be seen to do something because we've breached 5% much sooner than people thought we would. It's now expected to rise even higher. Yes, this probably won't make the slightest bit of difference to the inflation that we are suffering, but they have to be seen to act. And that is quite refreshing after many years of being extremely busy doing nothing. But the reasons why I don't think this will massively impact inflation, where's inflation coming from? Energy prices, the oil price. I mean, the cost of filling up a car is astronomical compared to what it was a year ago. People are being hit with much bigger energy bills. Food prices and some other stuff, that's really being caused by the supply chain issues and the supply chain crunch. And secondhand car prices have gone through the roof. Again, computer chip shortage, which is causing that stuff. Those things are going to get righted, but they're not going to get righted by the Bank of England moving interest rates up from not very much to a little bit above not very much.
To borrow the words of the great Yaz, from here on in, the only way is up.
Possibly, but I wouldn't expect the only way to be up too quickly. The Federal Reserve indicated that it plans 3 rate rises for next year. The Bank of England isn't quite so specific. It doesn't expect rates to go up by that much. But I think that maybe an earlier move will delay a second move next year, or we'll even see a second move relatively early in the year, and then we probably won't go anywhere for a while after that. I don't think we've cured inaction bias, but in any recovery, the first steps are the most important.
Indeed. And inflation, how high can that go? Well, it can go really high, but how high will that go? Tanya?
Well, Omicron might actually, as Andrew Bailey was kind of hinting, make things worse. We've got a lot of trouble with the supply chains, which have been massively skewed by the pandemic. And now Omicron is going to prolong it, potentially make it worse. And what we've seen is a real sort of shift in demand from services, because people haven't been able to go out and get services, to people buying stuff, and therefore sort of created unexpected demand in unexpected places at a time when the process of making things was thrown out of whack anyway by the virus. And that's just going to continue for the time being. So you can kind of see how the supply chain picture, you know, with unexpected demand and suppliers, you know, scrubbing to keep up with it, because understandably they don't know how the pandemic is going to influence, you know, consumer trends. And that is going to continue to put pressure on inflation. And that's never mind the issues in the energy market, which Simon was talking about.
Well, also, I mean, you have to remember that this isn't going to make a huge difference, as we said, but I think central banks are still hoping that this inflation problem is transitory. They're just not using the word transitory as much as they were, because it's been sticking around a bit too long for it to not be transitory. But the action of central banks and the mood music of central banks does make a difference here. I mean, why do you raise interest rates? You raise interest rates because it makes money a bit more expensive to borrow, and that the idea is that that then dampens demand. Mortgage rates are dirt cheap. Businesses can borrow at cheap levels. Banks are well capitalized. Not going to make a huge difference there. But as I said, it's the mood music. The Federal Reserve saying something, the Bank of England saying something. People sit up, they pay attention. And it's time to do that, because this 0.1% rate was brought in March 2020. As I've said before, we were in panic stations, unprecedented. We were about to go into lockdowns. Economies were shut down. We didn't know what was going to happen. We now have a much better picture of how our economy can survive that kind of shock. And it's maybe not as bad as people thought. Inflation's at 5.1%. House prices are rising at 10%. Banks are well capitalized. Mortgage rates are super cheap. Businesses can borrow if they want to. That doesn't look like a world where you need 0.1% interest rates. That looks like a world that could probably survive slightly higher interest rates. And emergency rates, they're not like dogs. They're for emergencies, not for life. right?
Got it.
Yet we've ended up sticking at super low levels for years. We did it after the financial crisis. We didn't even manage to get up off the 0.5% emergency rate before we cut it when the Brexit vote came in. And then we went down to 0.25%. Interest rates spent a bit of time, you know, watching Brexit and chill. And then they went up a bit and then they crashed again. And we need to learn that lesson that this time around, we need to not leave them at that super low level for years and years and years, because it gives you no room for maneuver when you need it in the future. And it distorts the economy and it distorts financial markets. And let's face it, we've had this 0.1% rate for nearly 2 years now. So yeah, it's time to get off it.
So time for recalibration, one would suggest, but are there any indications within the Bank of England, within the government, that we're going to get that?
Maybe. I mean, they just raised interest rates. They voted 8-1 to do it. And
yeah,
I must admit, I'm slightly surprised. I think they should have raised interest rates. I don't think it makes the damnedest bit of difference to inflation. I think I've made that clear. But I'm slightly surprised that they actually did it. And so, yeah, maybe things are a little bit different this time, and rates are going to rise. That's going to probably, if that does get baked in, that idea, that's definitely going to cause a few wobbles on the stock market, though, because a lot of money invested in the world is on the basis that rates aren't going anywhere.
All right, Tanya. So that's investors, that's stock markets. What about us? We spent years in this low interest rate environment. One, what's the material impact going to be initially? Savings, pensions, mortgages, that sort of thing. And then a bit more holistically, how do we get used to living in a different environment?
Well, as far as, we're talking about, I suppose, mortgages and savings here. With mortgages, people have got really no experience, no recent experience of higher interest rates. And the people who have sort of joined the housing market and bought in the last 12 years have been used to 1% or under, you know, under 1% in terms of the interest rate, the base rate. And the figures in terms of their situation are, it will go up by maybe a few hundred pounds on an average house for people on average income. If it goes up again, though, to 0.5%, then you're looking, I suppose, at people who are in maybe a £250,000 house, you know, paying an extra maybe £600 a month or thereabouts. So it will be significant. It will bear down on them. But you also have to remember that a lot of people are on fixed rates. And certainly initially, it feeds through eventually, but initially it's going to be the people on standard variable rates and trackers and people who have got on a mortgage that is still, like, run at a discount to the base rate. That's on the mortgage front. I mean, for savers, I think it will have quite a marginal effect unless you've got an awful lot of money stashed away. I mean, it's always the way, isn't it? But in terms of what people are going to be seeing, somebody crunched some numbers on saving £1,000. If you've got £1,000 saved, the best buy roughly for easy access, which people need, if you've got an emergency fund, which a lot of people, they might not have a great deal of savings, but they have got an emergency fund. So easy access, maybe about 0.7%. That's probably if you're lucky at the top end. So on £1,000, you might make £7 interest in a year. This would add an extra £1.50 to it, according to the calculations. So we're really talking a low amount. We've also talked a lot about pensioners and their fears about inflation. And they're obviously heading now for a 3.1% increase in the state pension in April. And the forecasting at the moment is that inflation could hit 6% by April.
Wow.
So that is obviously a real concern if that does play out as expected. And it could even be, because of all the things that we discussed, that inflation could hit 6% sooner than that. So, I mean, obviously people on a fixed income, like pensioners, they're going to have a really tough time with it. I mean, obviously there was a big rebellion and, you know, it may well be that the government will sort of rue not being a little bit more generous with pensioners, because in April they will be, having gone through the winter, having potentially had trouble heating their homes because they can't afford it, they're going to be putting a lot of pressure on the government at that point to help them.
All right, then. Well, let's stick with pensioners, if that's all right, Tanya. Bad news for those born from the early 1970s onwards, which is all of us here. You could be forced to postpone retirement if an official review recommends speeding up an increase in the state pension age to 68. Tanya, what is the current situation of when people can retire? What age? What's coming up? It's all change.
Well, it's currently 66 for both men and women if you're retiring now. Obviously, the issues with women's state pension age going up very fast, faster than was initially expected, are very well known, but they caught up with men and their state pension age. Between 2018 and 2020, everybody went up to 66. Now, then the next one going up to 67 is 26 to 28. So later on in this decade. What the government announced this week, though, and what the current discussion centres on is when does it go up to 68? And if the government stuck with what is legislated for and planned for, that would be between 2044 and 2046. It wouldn't happen till then, which is where you get people, it would affect people who were born from the late 70s onwards. But a couple of years ago, there was a big review. John Cridland from the CBI carried it out. So there was already a lot of talk about bringing it forward. And this review that was announced this week is basically they're having another look at what John Cridland recommended, which was bringing it forward to 37 to 39. Which is why it would start having more of an impact sooner. But it looks like they're going to be looking at it quite broadly. I mean, everyone always thinks, oh, well, it's going to go up. But experts have pointed out that life expectancy data has been a bit more mixed recently. It will have all been thrown completely out by the pandemic as well. And so they're going to have to get their head around that. They're going to look at the costs as well, the costs of an ageing population, the costs of the state pension, labour market trends, all sorts of things, as well as life expectancy. So we actually don't know what this latest review will come up with, but it's looking more like the state pension age will be raised sooner. If I had to bet, I'd say that it's probably going to go that way. But who knows? Who knows?
Simon, again, only way is up. I'm wondering if by the time we retire, will they also increase the age, do you think?
Yes, I think so. I think we fall into the slight bracket after this. I think that if you look at the polls, and bear in mind, these are just surveys when they ask people questions. It's quite interesting, the surveys that ask younger people in their 20s and 30s whether they think there'll be a state pension when they retire. And quite a lot of them go, no, they don't think there'll even be a state pension, let alone what age they'll get to retire. So I don't know. I do think, though, that a lot of the state pension age stuff, as Tanya explained, is predicated on life expectancy continuing to improve. And there is an interesting phenomenon going on where the expected improvements in life expectancy, there's a lot of expecteds in there, have not done what was expected in terms of continuing to improve. So maybe we'll see a shift around. But then at the other end of the scale, we're quite short cash in this country at the moment. And people do have a bit of a penchant for working for longer. Now, the pandemic's had an interesting effect on that with the great resignation and lots of people suddenly going, ah, you know what, I'm not going to work for longer. But there are people doing bits of work, and it's the not a full-time job but doing bits of work stuff that means that the government can get away with delaying the state pension a bit and things like that. But we're also staring down the barrel of a generation that's going to have worse pensions. So the people who are going to be affected by this, the people in their 40s, and then once you start moving lower, further down the scale, are going to be retiring with defined contribution pensions, which are inferior to the defined benefit pensions that the older generation have been largely retiring with. You've got people now retiring with a mix, but once you get to the generation in their early 40s, And you know, unless they've been public sector employees, you're not going to find many people with those defined benefit pensions. And the defined benefit pensions you do find are going to be less generous. And those are the people who are then going to be asked to work for longer before they can get their state pension, or just wait for longer before they can get their state pension and bridge the gap with their private pension.
How should we prepare for the change?
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because for all the reasons that Simon just said, there is pressure on people's savings and their ability to save, and we mostly have less generous pensions now. As far as the state pension itself goes, I think you should definitely keep an eye on the forecast. Go and look whether you've got a forecast. It doesn't matter how old you are. But in terms of actually doing something about it, if you've got gaps or you think you want to make top-ups, it's better to do that towards retirement itself, so you don't need to panic too early about it. You also need to remember that the effects of contracting out, which are, we won't go into great detail about it, but some people have their state pension lowered by previous arrangements in terms of contracting out of state pension contributions. By the time all this happens, that would all have sort of fallen out of the system for people retiring in the 2030s. That shouldn't be a factor at all. But really, I mean, I think that it's about getting your private pension sorted out. I know everyone says that, but the state pension is really useful in that it's guaranteed until you die. And because of the loss of final salary pensions, people are going to have, unless they buy an annuity, which remain, you know, very poor value, there's not a lot of kind of guaranteed income that you're going to have as part of your, you know, as part of your pension income. So therefore, I mean, obviously still make a real effort to sort out your state pension and maximise it as much as possible. But you've really got to save hard into your private and your work pensions. That's the only way. Make as much use of the free employer contributions as possible. If you up your own contributions, your employer will often match them, and it's worth looking into that, because that's just more free money that you're not putting in that they are putting in. And obviously take that also increases the tax relief you get as well. So it's really unfortunately a matter of saving harder and also maybe for longer.
All right then. Tanya, while we have you, an update on the state pensions delay.
Yeah, we've just published a new story. This continues to be a problem for some people. Just to give a recap, we reported in September that the government was really having a complete service meltdown with new state pension claims and also people trying to end deferments. And we had an awful lot of readers getting in touch with us. They were suffering absolute nightmare problems. And one of the issues was that a lot of benefits stop at 66. So people who were badly off were really hard hit, because if their pension didn't start and they were continually ringing the DWP and either not getting through or, you know, having to wait ages or not getting any action when they did get through, that was incredibly worrying for them because they had no income. And the government does seem to have improved things, possibly for the people who have just got very straightforward new claims. That was what they promised that they would do by the end of October, beginning of November. But we are still getting people writing in who are affected. And anyone with what Steve Webb, our columnist, describes as a non-standard state pension situation, which can be for all sorts of reasons, a period of work overseas, being a carer for somebody, living abroad, a whole myriad of things, all deferring your state pension, could actually mean that it takes a lot longer to sort out still. Now, these six cases that we've got, I mean, some of people have had an absolute ordeal. And we've got one case where a lady's state pension application just completely disappeared into thin air. She got her letter. She responded to a letter months before she was due to turn 66. She did it online, so a very standard application. She got a confirmation email. This was all back in April. Everything was sort of, you know, set fair for her to start getting her pension after she was 66 in the summer. And she rang twice to chase it up. and nobody alerted her that there was a problem. And it was only when we raised her case, months on, we're talking in November, that the DWP discovered that they had no record of this, despite her doing it and confirming it. And we've seen documents backing that up. And the DWP's response for that was, well, that wasn't a delay. The pension vanished, but they were at pains to point out to me that that was not a service delay. We've had another lady who had her state pension claim closed against her wishes. It absolutely boggles to me as to how the DWP could one-sidedly on its own decide to close someone's state pension claim. But she was told that it was going to be claimed on the phone, while she was on the phone to the DWP, on the basis that she had not communicated, she'd failed to communicate with the DWP while she was ringing them. So as you can see, people are absolutely hopping mad about this, and we still continue to get messages in. We'll see how many more we get and whether it starts to tail off. But while we still get messages in, and especially from people who are left with no income, some people have got, you know, their disability allowance stopped at 66. They've got no prospect of trying to fill the gap, and not everyone can rely on family. We'll have to carry on chasing the DWP up about this.
We do indeed, and keep us posted. Meanwhile, the government is under increasing pressure to include fraudulent paid-for adverts in the online safety bill. Now, the idea is a number of supporters, including MPs, who've long demanded action against harmful advertising, the kind which lures unsuspecting savers and investors to hand over their cash to fraudsters touting fake or clone deals and products. Simon, what ads are we talking about? What is the online safety bill?
The online safety bill is being brought in by the government in a bid to try to put a bit more regulation in place in the Wild West of the internet. It includes online harms, which is very, very wide ranging. And it's looking largely at the big tech platforms, trying to make sure that they are doing the right thing to protect their users. Everything from harassment to abuse, extreme pornographic images and stuff like that. But there's also obviously a key part where people can be harmed online and that has seen a major boom in recent years, and that is financial scams. Fraudsters are all over the place. People spend huge amounts of time on the internet. They use many, many different sites. They shop from many, many different places. They deal with many, many different companies. And that's a prime opportunity to defraud people and to try to scam them. But unfortunately, that's not been included within this online harms bill so far. But the government is under a lot of pressure to outlaw fraudulent paid-for adverts and force the big tech firms to take responsibility for the harmful advertising that lures savers and investors to hand over cash to fraudsters. So, for example, things promising good returns, and then people go through and they hand over their details, they hand over their money, and they get scammed. And it's a real problem because people find this stuff and they're not sure what's legit, what isn't. Some of it's quite convincing. Sometimes not even too good to be true. It's only just like slightly better than normal stuff that tempts people in. And it's a major problem for large publishers as well, because the tech giants don't just control their own sites and platforms. They also control a large amount of the online advertising industry. And there are also large advertising exchanges, and that can leave publishers facing a tough time in cracking down on these as well.
Tanya, you've been looking into this. How much damage is being caused?
Well, it's absolutely devastating for people who have who've lost money through these scams. It's really difficult to tell the difference between a legitimate ad and one that is fraudulent, when they're basically copying real brands, real sites, and people are signing up for them believing that they are real. And sometimes, because they believe they've got a real deal and they've put their money somewhere safe, it can sometimes take quite a long time for them to realize it's vanished. So it may even take years, because not everyone checks in that often. And it's often only when they ring up the real company that's been cloned or whatever, the company informs them that they've got no record of them, they've got no real account with them. And I think, unfortunately, these companies have to spend a lot of time breaking news to people that sometimes it's tens of, or even hundreds of thousands of pounds that people have put in what they assume to be completely legitimate products. If you are worried about this, and you should be, it's better, always better to be safe, especially if you're putting a lot of money in a financial product. The FCA has got a list of legitimate authorized companies, and they've got links to them as well. They've also got a warning list, but if you want a legitimate link, you can go to the FCA website and look at their registered list and use the numbers and addresses and links on there. If it's an investment platform as well, we've obviously got our roundup. We've got legitimate links in our platform roundup as well, if people are on this is money.
Finally, are we going to see it included in this bill, do you think?
It's difficult to know why it's not being included. I think it's something to do with the regulation, because Ofcom is going to look after this, whereas the FCA obviously looks after the financial scams. But the FCA is one of the bodies that have come out and said, yeah, you should be including this, actually. So it's a bit difficult to see why the government are holding out so hard. And there has been movement. I mean, all the pressure that has been piled on from the industry has had an effect, in that there have been more and more of the big tech giants who have been saying, we will only take ads from companies that are authorised by the FCA, which means obviously that the fraudsters are not going to be authorised by the FCA, let's hope anyway. And so that will help. I mean, you have to wonder why they weren't doing that already. I mean, you'd think anybody who was taking adverts, who cares about their users or their readers, would actually sort of ensure that the companies that they were taking money from and putting advertising up from were actually approved by the regulator involved before they actually took the money and put it up. But at least there is finally movement on that front.
I'd just say, from the point of it's worth noting, as I said before, that the way that the online advertising market works means that for some publishers, it can be very difficult. I know how difficult this is, because we get stuff that gets through because people do not. And so when you're reading websites, this is a really important thing, actually, to remember as an internet user, is when you are reading people's sites, even people's sites that you trust, the advertising on that site has not necessarily come from a direct relationship between the person, the advertiser, and the company. The vast majority of advertising on the internet nowadays is something called programmatic, and it goes through large ad exchanges. And so the advertiser often doesn't deal directly with the publisher. And so the publisher has less control than they would have done in the old days of advertising in terms of the adverts that appear there. So don't just trust an advert because it's on a legitimate site that you trust. Mm. If you think there's something suspicious about the advert, we've done lots of work to try and make sure that this stuff doesn't happen on our site, but it can be like a game of whack-a-mole sometimes, and things can still get through. And that is true of every single major publisher. So be careful. Okay. We take great care with the advertisers that we accept and we deal with directly on This Is Money. And we there's some stuff that we don't allow to be advertised at all, that is totally legit. But it can still happen. So be careful out there. I mean, we talked about this on the tube before, with TFL and stuff like that. It's like people see stuff on the tube. They think, oh, it's on the tube. I can totally trust that. It's, you know, most of the time you can, but not always. So just be careful about who you're giving your money to.
So Simon, knowing what you know, what is the solution?
Okay, what's the solution? Is to look at things critically, critical thinking. Okay, so sometimes it's really obvious if an advert is from a legitimate company, okay? It's like a nice, big, good-looking advert. It's when you get these funny, like, little list adverts that you see. People recognize those from around the adverts. It almost looks like a little listicle. And some of the things in that little listicle might be going to legitimate companies, but there might be a few in there. It's things that says stuff like fixed rate bonds. Watch out for anything that says fixed rate bonds in like a little listicle thing or something like that. Okay. Be really careful about some crypto stuff from names you don't recognize. One of the ones is like you go through to a fake story that's made to look like a story on a legitimate website, and it starts talking about some famous people's incredible returns from cryptocurrency. We had one of these stories a while back that George investigated because it looked like it was on ITV News's website, but it wasn't. If you looked at the URL, you could see it wasn't actually ITV News. But also the claims in it were just preposterous, and it quoted Jeremy Clarkson about how he'd found this Bitcoin trick and made loads of money. And George actually managed to get a comment from Jeremy Clarkson on it. He pointed out that it definitely wasn't him. I'm now, and said something very Clarkson like I'm now off to find out what a Bitcoin is.
Yeah, exactly. All right then, Simon, we'll put this to one side, but we're going to stick with crypto because forget about premium bonds from your relatives for Christmas. A survey by investment firm AJ Bell shows that many of us are thinking of buying cryptocurrency as a gift this year. True. Is that the case, Simon? Is that what you're thinking?
So if you were going to buy a child a speculative investment, what would you buy?
I'd go for a scratch card, personally.
A scratch card over crypto?
Stick it in a... Yeah,
I don't know whether... I think it depends why you're buying them. So people buy premium bonds for children, right? Because they want to give the children some money. They want it to be invested somewhere where it will deliver them a return. In all reality, the return you're going to get on premium bonds is minimal. The children are probably going to hold on to them for a very long time, but it's popular. Everybody likes them. It's safe. Their money's protected. It's not going to go down in value. Realistically, if you're going to give a child some money and that child's not going to need that money in the near future, which let's face it, most of the money gifted to children that isn't like immediate present gifting, not like the here's 30 quid and you can go buy yourself a present because I haven't bought you one. It's the here's some money to put into the savings account for them. The savings account's rubbish. The premium bonds, well, you might win a million. You probably won't. We talked about this in the past. Actually, there's the kind of long-term investing horizon there. Maybe the money should be invested instead. I mean, perhaps your child might have a junior ISA. Perhaps you might invest for your child anyway. Perhaps someone should give you the money to do that, but you might not do that. So maybe there's the thing of like, well, buy a child some shares. It can be a bit difficult nowadays because obviously most shares aren't held in paper certificates. They're held in online investment accounts. And you can't really open online investment accounts for other children that aren't yours. But, you know, maybe the child has one. Maybe you put some money into some shares in there. But the world is changing. You know, cryptocurrencies are all around us. People see the stratospheric returns. And you think, well, you know what? If I'm going to give a child 50 quid, maybe I should give them 50 quid's worth of Bitcoin. I mean,
how would you do that, Simon?
You'd be giving them 50 quid's worth of something that is extremely volatile and extremely high risk. But let's face it, if you're going to do something that's extremely volatile and extremely high risk, then maybe as a child, money that you're being given that you're not expected to ever use for about another decade or longer is the kind of money that should be used with it. Practically speaking, as you said, going to be quite difficult. I think practically speaking, the only way of doing it is saying, I've bought you 50 quid's worth of Bitcoin and I've put it in my account or something, or I've got your parents to have it in their account. Pretty sure that you can't open an account for a child and get 50 quid's worth of Bitcoin in it.
Keep the password safe as well. Just a wee tip.
I mean, that's if you go down the whole crypto wallet thing and everything like that. I mean, you'd probably just be better off doing it with one of the platforms that hold it. But I don't know. I mean, maybe not Bitcoin.
Good lesson
maybe
for
Ethereum.
Kids, though, Simon. Good lesson, you know, for
good lesson
about money.
For children. I mean, it might be a good lesson. So there's an interesting story in the FT from Lucy Kellaway a few weeks back, talking about the kids trading crypto on their phones in the classroom. This is talking about teenagers. Now, obviously,
times have changed.
Obviously, teenagers should not be trading crypto. Mm. They're not allowed to. But, you know, teenagers, they have this way of getting around stuff they're not meant to do. I don't know. Has that always happened? It didn't happen when I was a teenager.
No.
So, yeah, and they've all got phones nowadays and they're sitting there, you know, trading crypto. I'm up this much. I mean, they're basically gambling on their phones, but they don't realize that. And they see this warped world around them as well. You know, amongst the many warped worlds that we're pushing at teenagers nowadays, the whole get rich quick crypto, mm-hmm. you know, celebrity entrepreneur, flashy this, flashy that kind of thing, bling lifestyle. And they see that and they think, yeah, great. I can get rich quick. They are learning something. And some of them are maybe learning a valuable financial lesson, but some of them are also probably potentially risking money that they shouldn't be risking and gambling and potentially getting, you know, hooked on gambling. So maybe if you teach them about the volatility, the risk, the look at how much this has gone up and down, look how rich you thought you were in November, and now look how rich you feel you are. That's a good lesson to teach a child about high risk crypto trading, because anybody who's got crypto would have felt much richer on the 10th of November than they do now.
Tanya, thoughts?
I would not buy crypto for a child. I think it would be an absolutely balmy thing to do. If you want them to invest, a junior ISA, I mean, the parents can open them and then they can, you know, get family and family friends to put money in it. And with a junior ISA, you can do age appropriate discussion with a child as they get older about what's in it, what funds are in it, what shares are in it. You can relate it. If you bought Tesco, you can sort of point that out, you know, when you go to Tesco. And you can teach children valuable lessons about investing that they will take on through their lives. And then at 18, they will have access to it, and they can, you know, hopefully if it's grown, which it probably will have if you opened it when they were born, then they will have something that they can do with it. I mean, they might fritter it away, but they will have a decision, they will have an important financial decision to make at 18, and even if they make the wrong one, that will probably be valuable. That's the approach that I would take, frankly.
Balmy. Say it how it is, Tanya. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.